We've been talking about a theory that we hear a lot about, usually called the premillennial theory, because those who hold this theory believe that when Jesus returns, he will set up a 1,000-year reign on earth, and so his coming is before the millennium, so premillennial. And let me just, as we start, review quickly for you that theory that we've been talking about in our sessions. You have a copy of this chart with you, so I can direct you to places on it. This theory believes that there will be signs that tell us when Jesus is about to come. We've discussed that, and I would simply summarize our discussion of that by saying that we know that Jesus, when he comes, he'll come like a thief in the night, and that suggests there will not be any signs to tell us when he's coming. Then there will be the rapture, when living Christians are changed and dead Christians are raised, and they go up to be with the Lord in heaven. And then two antichrists will will rebuild the temple in Jerusalem during the first half of a 7-year tribulation period. And over here, there'll be war over Israel, climaxing in the Battle of Armageddon. And that's what our subject is today, this Battle of Armageddon. Is that what the Bible teaches? And the theory says that in the midst of that battle, Jesus will return and set up his 1,000-year reign on earth. And then after that, the bad dead will be raised and be a judgment day, and then will be the final eternity in heaven and hell. So today we're talking especially at this class hour about the Battle of Armageddon. Does the Bible teach that there will be some great war just before Jesus returns? That word Armageddon is used so often that it is to mean that it's become a part of the language structure. If you say to somebody, oh, well, that was Armageddon, they think immediately, oh, terrible times, difficulties just before Jesus returns and all that. And so that's the concept that people have generally from the word Armageddon. So the question is for us today, does the Bible teach that there will be, that the word Armageddon here means there'll be a great war just before Jesus returns? Now let's dig into that question a little bit. That word Armageddon occurs only once in the Bible. It's in the 16th chapter of Revelation and in verse 16. And so we need to get a little bit of a setting of the book of Revelation to see how that might play. The book of Revelation, I believe, was written to 7 churches in Asia Minor, which is today Turkey. And it was a letter from Jesus to these 7 churches to help them understand and be able to withstand the persecution that was coming. They were about to undergo terrible persecution by the Roman Empire, which would kill Christians by the thousands. Some say that the Romans killed as many as 6 million Christians during the 2 centuries that they persecuted the church. Nobody knows how many, but it was a great number. And so they were about to undergo this terrible persecution, and Christ wants to send them a message that will help them have some understanding of what's going on and to be able to endure and to be faithful during that time. So that's the main thrust of the book of Revelation. We'll see more of that in a moment. But the main thing is to hold on during this hard time. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Now, the term Armageddon then is only found in Revelation 16:16, and it reads like this. Then they gathered the kings together to the place that in Hebrew is called Armageddon. So what does Armageddon mean? What is the meaning of that term? Well, first of all, I think we want to learn that we need to take the word Armageddon figuratively. Rather than applying it to something literal, it needs to be seen figuratively. And let me explain to you why I believe that is the case. The first reason we ought to take it figuratively is because we're in the midst of a figurative passage. In Revelation 16, 13, we begin to hear about a dragon who talks with a beast and a false prophet who is also a beast, and they conspire together to send frogs out of their mouths to gather the kings at Armageddon. A dragon and two beasts and frogs. Do you suppose there's anything figurative in this passage? Well, of course. So the dragon, as we learn in chapter 12, verse 9, is Satan. It tells us that whenever it says dragon, it means Satan. What am I about to do? Remember this from the other night? Okay, everybody put your hands like this. Everybody, hands like this. Now repeat after me. This is what it says. Oh, that won't do, friends. Let's start over. Everybody put your hands like this. Now repeat after me. This is what it says. That's better, but not good enough. This is what it says. This is what it means. Okay. It says dragon means Satan. It says beast, first beast, and it means Roman Empire. It says second beast, and the second beast represents the cult of emperor worship. We don't have time in this class this morning to go through the clues that are given to tell us those meanings, but that's my understanding of the book of Revelation, is that it has these figures, the dragon and the two beasts. And so we're in the midst of a figurative passage. And they send frogs out of their mouths. Now, the second reason that I would regard this as a figurative passage is because of the use of the word Armageddon. You'll see hidden in the word Armageddon the word Megiddo. Armageddon. Armageddon. Megiddo was a site in Israel that sat right by a hill that sat right by the valley of Jezreel. And so this was a place of very strategic battles that we're told about in the Old Testament. It's a place where Deborah defeated Sisera, where Gideon defeated the Midianites, where Saul and Jonathan fought the Philistines and soon were killed, where King Amaziah and King Josiah both met their death in battle in the valley of Jezreel, right beside the hill of Megiddo. And so this sense of going to Megiddo means going to a place to have a last stand battle. That's what they had at Megiddo. Take the word Waterloo, for example. Have you ever heard the expression, meet your Waterloo? San Antonio met their Waterloo last night. I don't know how many of you are Thunder fans, but anyway, I was pleased that San Antonio met its Waterloo. That means to get defeated. They were defeated last night. So, to meet your Waterloo is to use the word Waterloo, which is a place of a famous battle, in a figurative sense. To meet your, you don't have to go to Belgium, that's where Waterloo is. You don't have to go to Belgium to meet your Waterloo, do you? You can meet your Waterloo right here. So Megiddo is used in that sense to mean a last-ditch stand. So in this story, this is used in a figurative sense. Armageddon, because it was a place of so many decisive battles, it can be used figuratively to mean a last-ditch stand. So, as we approach the passage, we need to understand that we're talking about a passage that's filled with figures of speech, and we need to learn to take Armageddon figuratively like we would take the dragon and the two beasts and the frogs figuratively. Now, let's move on to the next thing that we can learn about this. We need to put Armageddon in the Revelation timetable. Whatever this means, it must fit the timetable of the book of Revelation. What does the book of Revelation tell us about its own timetable? When was the storyline? See, Revelation is a story told here with a meaning here. So here's the story, and here's the meaning. And when was the, what does the book of Revelation tell us about its own timetable? Its own timetable. Coming soon, that's right. So look at these passages about coming soon. Revelation 1, verse 1, the very first verse, says that the book of Revelation is about things that will shortly come to pass. Does that mean shortly starting now? No, it means shortly starting then, when the book was written and delivered to the seven churches. So to those churches, it was about something that would happen soon. I don't think that means 2,000 years later. Something would happen soon. And come on down to Revelation chapter 1, verse 3. It says it's about things that will happen soon. Or Revelation 22, 6, I come quickly, Jesus says. When Jesus says, I come quickly, what does he mean? Does he mean, I come quickly, but it'll be 2,000 years? Does he mean, is he talking about his second coming when he says, I come quickly? Don't think so. He's talking about, I come quickly to do what I've said in this book, I will do. I'm going to carry out what I say is going to happen in this book. I'm going to come quickly to carry it out. The Bible often speaks of God coming to defeat the Egyptians, or God coming to do something with the Babylonians. That is, God is, doesn't mean God is going to come literally and walk on earth. It means that God is going to see that it happens. So Christ, when he says, I come quickly, doesn't mean I'm coming in my second coming. He means I'm going to stay in heaven, but I'm going to see that what happens is what I've said will happen. I'm going to bring it to pass. And so the book of Revelation talks about a timetable that is that will play out relatively soon. Actually, it played out over a span of about 200 years. It was written about the end of the first century, and the persecution ended in about 300 AD. So about 200 years this took to unfold as far as the persecution of Christians and to bring it to an end, and then another 100 years and the Roman Empire has gone down to defeat. So that's the timetable of the book of Revelation. And so whatever Armageddon is, it has to fit into that timetable. And if that's the case, it must already have happened, because we're 2,000 years later now. So Armageddon would happen soon from the standpoint of the first century. This book was written, I guess the first principle of understanding the Bible is you first have to understand it like the people who first received it understood it. Whether that's Colossians or Ephesians or Romans or Revelation, you have to say, what did this mean to the people who first got it? Now if I understand that, then I can say, now what did the Lord want me to get out of it? But we first have to say, what did it mean to them? To them, this was a figurative expression about something that would happen soon. That's what we've learned so far. Now, the third thing I'd like to say about Armageddon is this. We need to put Armageddon in the storyline of Revelation. It is part of this story. It's part of this story. Now let's take a quick look at the storyline of the book of Revelation. If you have your Bibles open to Revelation chapter 6, verse 9. Revelation chapter 6, verses 9, 10, and 11 are the key verses in understanding the book of Revelation. These are very critical in understanding the book. And if we get these verses, it'll tell us what the book of Revelation is about. It'll tell us a lot of what the book of Revelation means. Revelation 6, verses 9, 10, and 11. Here we're in the midst of the breaking of seven seals, which is just a way of saying, here's how the story will unfold. I'm going to tell you this much and this much and this much and this much. And the first four seals are opened. Horsemen ride across the stage, and they represent God's power among the nations. God has power to raise up nations and to make nations fall. That's what the four horsemen are about. Now the fifth seal comes in chapter 6, verse 9. And when the fifth seal is opened, I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their testimony under the altar. I saw the souls of those beheaded for their testimony. Who are these? Well, we see them throughout the book of Revelation. And they are the souls of those who have been killed because they've confessed Jesus. They've confessed Jesus and got killed for it. And these are the early martyrs. And these early martyrs have a question for God. And the question is, how long, O Master, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that are on the earth? Lord, we got killed for you. We were martyrs for you. And the one that did it seems to be getting away with it. Why don't you stop it, God? How long, O Master, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that are on the earth? Lord, the one that's killing Christians is still killing Christians like they killed us. Why don't you stop it? How long are you going to let this go on, God? Now, in the storyline, that question is put in the words of the martyrs who've already died. But don't you suppose those Christians on earth who were seeing their friends killed and their family killed had that question in their minds? Lord, your church is getting persecuted. How long are you going to let this happen? Why don't you stop? God, you have the power. You can stop it if you want to. Why don't you stop this persecution? Now, you would think that God's answer would be, oh, that's a good idea. I'll stop it. But that's not what he says. He says to them, take a white robe and wait until more of your brethren have experienced what you have. There's been persecution. There's going to be more persecution. Now, time out from the book of Revelation a moment. As we look back on that persecution, what do we see? Was it a hindrance to the church? Did it decrease the number of Christians? Did it keep the church from spreading? What was its effect?
It got bigger.
It got much bigger. And persecution scattered Christians, and as they were scattered, they spread the word. It caused people to see how devoted they were, that they would be willing to confess Christ, even if it meant they died, and they died with such honor and calm that the church grew like crazy. Until one writer says there were 34 million Christians by 350 A.D., and much of that was due to the way the Christians were faithful during persecution. That's what this book is about. Be faithful during persecution. And so the martyrs cry out, Lord, why don't you stop this? How long before you judge and avenge our blood on them that are on the earth? Why don't you stop the one? Why don't you bring down that power that's killing Christians? How long? And God says, wait a while until more of your brethren have experienced what you have. So from that we learn there's been persecution. There's going to be more persecution before God stops the persecution. Now that's all critical to understanding the book of Revelation. So we understand from this very important passage what the storyline is going to be about. And so there's going to be more persecution. Now, in chapter 12, we learn Satan's strategy. God reveals the strategy of Satan. In chapter 12, the dragon is introduced for the first time. The dragon, say it with me, stands for Satan. Satan. And the there's a woman there in chapter 12 who represents the plan of God, and she is about to bear a child, and that child is Christ. And Satan tries to, Satan is the dragon, he's going to kill the child as soon as it's born, and God takes the child up to heaven, and Satan can't get him. And then Satan attacks the woman. And Satan second makes war in heaven, try to keep Christ from taking his place in heaven. And he can't do that. Satan is cast down. The angels fight. How do angels fight, Forrest? They use these laser swords things? I don't know how angels fight. I haven't got the slightest idea how angels fight. But there's war in heaven. And the good angels win. And Christ takes his place at the right hand of God. And so Satan is prevented there from keeping Christ from taking his place at the right hand of God. And there he can be our Savior and forgive us of our sins. Then Satan turns against the woman and tries to destroy the woman. God won't let him do that. And then in the last verse of chapter 12, Satan says, okay, I didn't stop the child on earth, who is Christ. I didn't stop Christ from taking his place in heaven. I couldn't get rid of the plan of God. But now I'm going to turn my attention to the seed of the woman. That is, those who hold the testimony of Jesus. So Satan is now saying, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to persecute the church out of existence. I couldn't stop Christ from doing what he came to do. I couldn't stop him in heaven. I couldn't stop the plan of God. But I'm going to try to persecute the church out of existence. That's Satan's strategy. And he brings up to help him in that plan two beasts. In chapter 13, he brings up two beasts. And these two beasts are going to, so Satan says, okay, if I want to persecute the church, what's the most powerful force on earth that I can get to persecute the church? The Roman Empire. I mean, what chance would the little church have against the Roman Empire? So he says, I'll turn the Roman Empire against the church. That's the weapon I'll use to persecute the church is the Roman Empire. But how am I going to get the Roman Empire not to like the church? Emperor worship. So I'll develop more emperor worship and have Rome put up more temples to worship emperors. And that, historically, that's what happened. And so there's more emphasis on emperor worship. And Satan knows, okay, how can I lose? If they worship the emperor, they've violated their faith and they're gone. And if they don't worship the emperor, they're killed and they're gone. It's a foolproof system, Satan thinks he's got. But it doesn't work that way. Because Christians are faithful, and their faithfulness and their determination and their willingness to suffer turns out to be an attraction for other people to come. And so Satan's strategy is to use emperor worship, and Christians will have to choose between Christ and the emperor as their God. And then in the book of Revelation, God reveals this strategy, but then he also reveals that he will eventually destroy the Roman Empire. And that's where we come to chapter 16, where we started with Armageddon. God says in the first 12 verses of chapter 16, he says that by the blowing of the trump, by the pouring out of the bowls, he tells, I'm going to pour these bowls out on those who are persecuting my people. The first bowl is poured out on the land, and those who follow the Roman emperor break out with grievous sores. And the second bowl is poured out on the sea, and it turns red, and everything in it dies. And the next bowl is poured out on the rivers, and the rivers turn to blood. And those who drink it are the ones who are persecuting Christians, and they, obviously drinking the blood, is going to kill them. The fourth bowl is poured out on the sun and makes everything hot, and people blaspheme God. And the fifth bowl is poured out on the throne of the beast, the Roman Empire. And the sixth bowl is poured out in the Euphrates River, which was the boundary of the Roman Empire, and allowed the forces to come in from the Goths and the Visigoths and the Huns and the Vandals to destroy Rome. And so in these first six bowls, we learn that God is going to destroy Rome by various natural disasters, by turning its throne dark because of its immorality. And then he's going to let outside forces come in and attack. And if you read a history of the history of the Roman Empire, you'll find out that those are the very things that brought it down. What brought the Roman Empire down was its own immorality and its corruption, attacks from outside, and natural disasters, earthquakes and fires and floods. And so God tells in the first 12 verses here how he will bring the Roman Empire down to defeat. By natural disasters, by the results of its own corruption, and by outside attacks. Now here we are back to chapter 16, verse 13. And what this passage means is Satan and his allies are not going to go down without a fight. Satan and the first beast, the Roman Empire, the second beast, or false prophet as it's called here, get together and they say, wait a minute. God has unleashed these forces against us. Let's resist. And their resistance is suggested symbolically by saying, let's go to Armageddon. That's where people have made a last-ditch stand. Let's gather our forces like people used to do at Megiddo. Not literally going there, but let's rally our forces like people rallied at Megiddo. So it's the effort of Satan and his two allies to withstand what God has set in motion to destroy the Roman Empire because it was a persecutor of Christians. Now, they're going to rally then at Armageddon. Now, the next thing that happens is the seventh bowl is poured out, and a voice from the throne says, it is done. Which means Satan's effort to keep God from destroying the empire didn't work. And the great city fell in pieces, and hail and things happened, which all suggest the downfall of the Roman Empire, the persecuting force. And so at that point, we see how this piece, Revelation 16, 13 through 16, fits into the storyline of the book of Revelation. It's not about the end of the world. It's about the destruction of the persecuting power of the Roman Empire. So, the last thing I would suggest is this. Armageddon is not a final battle before the end. He's not talking here. It's a figurative expression about the fall of Rome, the persecutor. We're not in end of the world territory. The book of Revelation talks about the end of the world, as we will see in our church service in a little bit. It does have an appendix that goes on from the main storyline to say what's going to happen at the final judgment. But that's in chapters 20 through 22. What we have here is not about the end of the world. It's about the storyline of things that will shortly come to pass, that will happen soon. I come quickly. And so our understanding of Armageddon must fit within that time frame. The Bible does not teach that the end of the world will come with a great war. That's something that seems to be so commonly held by so many, that there'll be a great, terrible war right at the end of the world. But that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible says the end will come like the thief in the night, 2 Peter 3:10. Come like a thief in the night. Jesus said he did not know when the end would be, Matthew 24:36. And he said in Matthew 24:37 that the days preceding the end would be normal days like they were before the flood. Was there a great war just before the flood came? Was there some sign by which people knew that the flood was coming? No. Were they eating and drinking and giving in marriage? Just doing the normal things of life? And suddenly the flood came. And so it will be with us. Normal things, doing what? Eating and drinking and getting married and whatever will be going on. And suddenly Jesus returns. He comes like a thief in the night. There's no great war just before the end of the world that would give us a clue that the end is about to come. Comes like a thief in the night. So we have normal days preceding it. So our conclusion then is this. Armageddon is a figure to speak of Satan's desire to resist God's judgment on the Roman Empire, and not a prediction of a final battle on earth. So the common use of Armageddon is not the Bible use of Armageddon. And the belief that the world will end in a great war is not the meaning of this passage. And so we need to understand how this passage fits into the storyline of the book of Revelation, how it fits in the idea of will happen soon, shortly come to pass. We need to understand how it describes Satan's effort to resist God's plan finally to bring down the persecuting power. Remember now back to chapter 6, verse 9. Let's go back to that in light of what we've learned now. The martyrs cry out. The ones who have been killed for the testimony cry out, "How long, O Master, holy and true, do you not judge and avenge our blood on them that are on the earth? God, why don't you bring this persecution to an end?" God says, "Not now. Take a white robe and wait. It's going to go on for a while." And then when, it doesn't say that in those verses, but the implication is, but after a while, God is going to bring it to an end, and he's going to bring the Roman Empire down to defeat, and that's what happened. And so we have then this storyline that tells about the persecution and about how it's going to go on for a while, and then it'll come to an end. And as we look back on it from our vantage point, we can see that Satan's effort to persecute the church out of existence backfired. It spread the church. It actually attracted more to Christianity. It gave it a prominence in the Roman Empire that caused people to want to know about it, and they were drawn to it. And they people by the millions became Christians because it was because the Christians were faithful and they lived good lives and they helped people and they served people, and as people looked at them, they saw, "Wow, this is a good religion. I want to be a part of this." Well, you may get killed. Yeah, I know, but if I get killed, I'll go to heaven. That'll be okay. That's what the book of Revelation says. And so it's a powerful book to tell us, be faithful under any circumstance. Maybe tough, maybe hard, maybe suffering. Things on earth may not be what you wish they were. But wait. In the end, it's all going to work out okay. God will make it work out okay. Now, the interesting thing about the book of Revelation is that the storyline of the book starts in chapter 4 with God seated on his throne and everybody worshiping God. All the angels, all the created beings are worshiping God. And the message to those being persecuted is God's still in charge. God's in his heaven. And all's right with the world, as Browning put it. And so, when we have troubles and difficulties and hardships, the message for us is, just remember, God's still up there. And he has a way of working things out. And it may not be the way we would have written the script, you know. But God has a way of working things out in the long run. Just be faithful. Do the right thing. Do what God calls on you to do. And God will take care of it. Eventually, it'll work out. Not right now. We may have to wait, like these people did. But eventually, God will work it out. So, that message from the book of Revelation, we've kind of scanned through the book a little bit, focusing on the idea of Armageddon to see what that means. And we see that it is not what often is thought to be a great war just before the end of the world. It's God's effort to bring down the persecuting power when he's ready to do that, and Satan's resistance to say, no, I'm not going to give in to that, but God says, yes, you will, and it is done. That's all she wrote, dear John, I've sent your saddle home. That's not exact quotation, but that's what it means. Okay. Well, anybody have a question you'd like to ask about this? Okay.
Mm-hmm. What we know about Revelation.
Yeah, okay. The question is some artifacts that support the book of Revelation. The idea of emperor worship is clearly established by artifacts. If you go to the city of Ephesus, for example, the ruins of the city of Ephesus have been uncovered and are magnificent to see. And there is in the city the ruins of a temple that was three stories high, and on the top story is where they worshiped the emperor. And the area, not the building, but the area on which the building sat was a football field wide and five football fields long, huge place, three stories high. And it was built for the worship of Emperor Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian, a father and two sons. And they've recovered some of the statue of Domitian, which is about three times life size. I mean, the head is huge like this. They have a museum there in which they've found that. And down the street from that is the temple to Trajan. And in the seven churches, Ephesus is one of the seven churches to which this book was written. And down the way a little bit is our other cities. I've been on a trip to these seven churches, and there are gates that are dedicated to the emperor, and there are buildings dedicated to the emperor, and there's all kinds of indications of emperor worship. So it was a big thing in those days, and Christians were subjected to that kind of persecution. We also know about Polycarp, who was from one of these seven churches. I've forgotten which one right now, but one of these seven churches, and about 150 A.D., his story takes place, which is 50 years after, or 60 years after this was written. And we have the story of Polycarp, who was an elder in the church. And he was told by the Roman officials, you must worship the emperor, or we're going to burn you alive. And his response was, 86 years I've served him. I can't deny him. You'll have to burn me. And they burned him alive. And we have many records of about the persecution of Christians. And so it was a very big thing. And finally, Emperor Constantine in 315 A.D. Gave an edict to say that Christianity was accepted by the Roman Empire. And eventually it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. But that didn't save the empire. God went ahead and brought it down like he said he would. But it's interesting that the Roman Empire, so big and so powerful and so strong, and this little fledgling church comes along, and Satan gets them to persecute the church, and before long, the church has spread and become a major force in the Roman Empire and suffers persecution for about 200 years. And then finally an emperor says, not anymore. and Christianity. I believe Christianity is still here and the Roman Empire is not. Is that, would all of you agree with me on that one? If we don't know, we may not agree on everything about Revelation, but at least we agree Christianity is here and the Roman Empire is gone. So that's fundamentally the message of the book, and there's lots of evidence of emperor worship. Yes? That's what we're talking about at church time. So hang on to that. We're going to talk about chapter 20, 21, and 22. Chapter 20 tells what happened to Satan. So we'll talk about that then. If I tell you now, nobody will show up for church. That's a very good question. See, the two beasts have gone down to defeat, and Satan's still there. And so the question you've asked is exactly the question Revelation goes on to answer. Somebody else a question. All righty. I guess that will end our class, and appreciate you being here. We'll see you in a few minutes.